An Interview with Margaret Wheatley. Margaret Wheatley is well known in the fields of organization, management development, and systems thinking. She is President Emerita of the Burkana Institute, a charitable global leadership foundation serving life-affirming leaders. Her newest book is Finding Our Way, Leadership for an Uncertain Time. In an earlier book, Turning to One Another, Simple Conversations to Restore Hope to the Future, she promotes the idea that real social change comes from the ageless process of people thinking together in conversation. Last spring, Margaret Wheatley was the featured speaker at one of a series of Conversations That Matter, held at the Foundation offices in Palo Alto, and sponsored by the Foundation's Global Mind Shift team. Wheatley incorporated into her talk the four principles the Mind Shift team has adopted as helpful concepts for a positive change in world thinking: be present, be authentic, be inclusive, be responsible. The following is a condensation of her talk. Toward Sanity in a Time of Chaos. I think these four skills are all about creating conditions for effective relationship. And for me, that is the absolute basis, the bottom line, the foundation of all human activity. So if we're present, if we're authentic, if we're inclusive, and if we're responsible, there is no doubt that we would be in very high relationships. We would be creating the conditions by which all of life advances and organizes. We have a great burden in America, a great problem that actually paralyzes us. It is the belief that you can get through life alone, and if you have to rely on other people, there is something wrong with you. We are the most extreme example of social Darwinism, which was a really terrible thought to begin with. Only the strong survive. You see it in our social policies, in our welfare system, in our legislation. Those who survive are better than everyone else who is failing, and society does not have a responsibility to its weakest and poorest. This is what we have come to believe in America, because we would be destroying evolution if we supported the weak, since only the strong will give us the future. One way this crazy ethos shows up in our daily lives is that we think we are the only one who is failing, or we think that we are the only one who feels fear or rage, or we are the only one who isn't getting it. And when we fail, we think it's our fault, a belief reinforced by our bosses and congressional leaders and legislators who tell us it's not their fault, it's our fault. This burden of being an individual and thinking that you can go through life by yourself, that you will make it if you are good, and that you will fail if you are bad, and good riddance to you because you are only bringing down the species anyway, only exists in America. Yet it is a doctrine that we are now succeeding in promulgating around the world with consumerism and materialism and the effects of globalization. I don't imagine that a group of my colleagues in Zimbabwe or India or Brazil would be talking this way, but here we really need to. Were we in a different culture, we would be in a different conversation. For me, the most liberating thing I can do these days is go and live in another culture and get out of this insanity for a while, and realize that it is still possible for people to love each other, to enjoy working together, to not be focused on materialism. I had a startling experience recently when I was in Senegal. Senegal is a third world country. It is very poor, but they have very high levels of education, which is an anomaly. They have 100,000 college graduates, some with doctorate degrees, but they don't have jobs for them. So part of the work of the Burkana Institute is to support younger leaders who are trying to develop social entrepreneurs from this very well-educated but jobless segment. Senegal is not a comfortable place to be because of the pollution and the aggression and the poverty. But Senegal has no suicide, which is incomprehensible since high adolescent suicide rates are common and rising in many more well-off nations. But in Senegal, there is no suicide, there is no hunger, and there is no homelessness. In a very poor nation, people have each other. This is, for me, the great loss that we suffer in America. We don't realize that we are all that we need, that we are the solution. Instead, we in this culture face a growing uncertainty and increasing fear, which I think is being fueled deliberately. So it is important to be reminded that what we need is each other, and that the greatest problem we face is our fear of each other, our fragmenting from each other, our polarizing from each other. One of my friends said recently, "You know, America is falling apart in front of our eyes, and we have to make a choice. Are we going to come back together, or are we going to disintegrate?" When I was doing the book Turning to One Another on conversations, what I was so struck by is how healing environments are created just by one person being willing to be present to another. Not to fix the other, but just to listen to their story. In the video we saw, Marshall Rosenberg was doing exactly that. He kept asking questions, and he was willing to just be there and let the other person speak. He wasn't arguing, he wasn't defending, he wasn't saying, "Well, you don't quite understand." To be fully present and just listen is a gift that we can give to each other. From it, the most outrageous healing occurs. It's as if the universe is set up to make life easy to be in relationship with each other, because the universe is all about relationships. Nothing living lives alone, except we Americans. Being present to another person is an aspect of inclusivity. We are each now so enmeshed in our own interpretation of events that we, at least most of us, really don't want to get inside another person's head. It's clear that we are not really interested. We watch the news programs that support our worldview. It is terrifying, but true. We are not even dealing with the same information anymore. So it is important to sit down with someone and just say, "I'd really like to know what you are thinking. I'd really like to know how you see the world." This is how we get inclusive, when we are curious about how another person sees things. But this is not a great time for curiosity in America. We are all so certain that we are right, and we actually know that they are wrong. Another thing we suffer from at an overarching level in Western society, and more so in America than in any place else, is that we believe we can make up the rules that govern the universe. We play God. We don't have to follow the basic rules of life. Evolution doesn't apply to us. So we discard and ignore the rules by which the planet runs, the rules that sustain life. Nature says that in a healthy ecosystem, there is no waste. Every species has its little niche and doesn't rob other species. If predatory species destroy their habitat, they ultimately die. Because we believe we can create our own set of rules, we are an endangered species today. I heard one of the discoverers of the double helix talk about all the things that could be accomplished by genetic engineering, and he said quite casually, "If we don't play God, who will?" We are going to rewrite the book on science, on life. We're going to make the planet work the way we think it should work. No death, no obesity, no mental illness. Because we'll just figure out how to stop nature and take over. We're also going in the wrong direction in America on the idea of effective leadership and how to motivate people. The current idea of an effective leader is the person who is the strongest, the most commanding, the most controlling. The "trust me, I will save you" rhetoric that you hear at the highest levels is everywhere, not just in the president's office. It's in corporations, it's in schools, it's in legislatures. The belief that the leader has to take charge and tell people what to do, and then we will all do it. Along with that is another dominant trend now, the belief that we are best motivated by fear and punishment. So that if you put a strong command and control leader who beats people up, you'll get what you need. You can see this trend in the way we are treated at work these days, and in such legislation as No Child Left Behind, which threatens teachers with the loss of their schools if they don't comply within 3 years. I know that there are many of us in America who are unhappy with what is going on, who want to see change, who want to make a difference. But too often, we are scared to death that if we step forward, we're going to lose something. It's a dilemma for our society. Are we going to stand up for what we believe? And are we willing to pay the price? I listened to a national educator talk about the silence that has come over the people in his field for fear of losing grants, for fear of getting on lists, for fear of losing their jobs. These fears are real. So for us to really step up and act responsibly is becoming a bigger and bigger issue. Since I work in a lot of other cultures where people have stood up, I realize that they are not imprisoned by their material comforts. When you have nothing to lose, it is much easier to get out on the streets. I define a leader in a very different way than most people do. I define a leader and work with this definition throughout. This is infused in the Berkana Institute's work, that a leader is anyone who is willing to help. It's not a position. It's not a role. It's not something that you are born with or not born with. It's what happens to you as an individual or as a community when you see something that must be changed and you suddenly find yourself active, having stepped out and said, "I can't stand the way this person treats employees," or "I don't like what is going on in my child's school," or "I think there is a problem with this billboard," or "This water is polluted." Suddenly, you find yourself willing to help on some issue. I think that's when you become a leader, by simply being willing to step forward, take a stand, and get engaged. It's not because you've come up with the perfect solution. One of the statements I just hate is, "Don't give me the problem. Don't make the complaint unless you've got a solution." I don't think anyone has solutions at the beginning of anything. All we need to do is notice the things that are truly bothering us, those issues that affect our heart. That's when we find courage. Courage comes from the old French word for heart. You don't think yourself into courageous action. You can only feel the necessity to act, and out of that comes courage. Courage is linked to our hearts, not to our heads. From Timeline Magazine, July-August 2005, read by Carolyn Goss.